And welcome back. Hope you had a good weekend. We step off into another week already. I guess it's the middle of March already. Gee. First up tonight is our regular monthly update on the genetic modification of the seeds producing the food we eat, which are producing changes within us, which we have no control over because we got no representation, folks. That's the bottom line. Jeffrey Smith knows as much about this as anybody will probably ever know. We are graced by his presence once a month. He, of course, the author of the magnificent benchmark book, Seeds of Deception, which if you go to his website, not only will you find that book or the video, you'll see the GM trilogy, which we talked about last visit. But let's get right business now. Welcome, Jeffrey, back. How are you doing?
Real good, Jeff. Thank you.
Good, good. Let's step right into it then and go.
Okay. I just left today from Anaheim, California, where the Natural Products Expo convention was held over the weekend.
Now, that's been going on, if I remember, for quite some time. Is it not an older...
It is the largest annual convention for natural products. Thousands and thousands of people are there.
Right. That must have been an eye-opener for people who first-timers in there. They wouldn't even know about 90% of the products unless they're really on top of this. But go ahead.
Right. Well, we had a presentation that I want to tell you about, which is groundbreaking, actually. I've been working secretly, before this announcement, with some CEOs from companies and some technical experts. And the plan that I helped put together, and I want to back up by four, I want to lead into it, because this is dramatic, and I want to milk it for everything it's worth.
Sure, you bet. Go ahead. I'd love
All
it.
All right. The reason why there's no GMOs in Europe is because the European consumers were told about the risks in many, many articles in the beginning of 1999, starting actually with a whistleblower who had been gagged by threats of lawsuit, and by an act of parliament he was able to speak, and he's the one that discovered massive damage of rats that were fed genetically engineered potatoes,
right,
et cetera. And when
if I might, Jeffrey, this is important. For all of you out there who don't know about the trials, the tests with rats and GM, this is really a crucial area. Maybe we can get back to that later, but we're talking about 40 to 50% mortality rates of baby rats?
Well, yeah, this was the Russian rat study. This was a different study, but yes, the most recent of it was that there was about a 56% mortality rate among the offspring of rats that were fed genetically engineered
GM.
Soy.
Yep. Okay, go ahead.
So, anyway, the whistleblower is able to speak about the fact that inherently this genetic engineering, where you transfer genes from one species to another, it's not like Legos. It causes massive damage and changes to the DNA. And in his case, the rats that were fed supposedly harmless genetically engineered potatoes developed potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, liver, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system. Anyway, when he was able to speak, within a week there was 159 column feet of articles written in Europe, and a commenter wrote in an editorial that the entire society in Europe had been split into two warring blocks. Now, within 2 months, there was just too much agitation by consumers, and Unilever, Britain's largest food manufacturer, publicly committed to remove genetically engineered ingredients from their European brands. Within a week, so did virtually every major food manufacturer.
Wow.
Again, for their European brands. And so McDonald's, Burger King, Safeway, Nestle's, in Europe, they don't put GM ingredients in their products. But in the United States, where 60% of Americans say they've never eaten a GMO in their life, they continue to be fed GM by these corporations.
Of course. Yep.
So
yep.
The way to, what is the roadmap to dismantle the grip that GM has on the U.S. diet, and it's to achieve the tipping point in the U.S. to create a Euro-style revolt by the same companies that have committed to remove GM ingredients from your European brands and also their Chinese brands. And so how do you create that tipping point? Well, one of the areas that we're working at, and we'll talk about other areas at some other time, but one of the main and most important areas is health-conscious shoppers, people who already make decisions of what to buy and eat based on what they consider to be healthy. Now, I predict that if we had even 5% of Americans switching their brands based on GM content, just make sure they're eating non-GM, that's more than the tipping point that we need to get Kraft and Nestle's, etc., to follow suit. However, we already have 28 million Americans, almost 10% of Americans, buy organic on a regular basis. Another 54 million people buy it on an irregular basis. But most people in both categories don't avoid genetically engineered ingredients in their non-organic purchases. The trajectory here to reach a tipping point quickly is, what if we could empower the health-conscious shopper to buy non-GM? And so here's what we've announced, basically, in the Campaign for Healthier Eating in America, which is being sponsored by my Institute for Responsible Technology.
Right.
We are going to migrate the entire natural and organic food industry into verified, third-party verified non-GM status. We are going to offer GMO information centers to all the natural food stores in America. And we are going to have a trajectory that in about 18 to 20 months after the migration is complete, we're going to offer in-store, on-shelf labeling of anything that still may contain GMOs. And in the lead-up to that, we're going to offer non-GMO shopping guides in the stores so that people can look at the brands, look at the products in the store, and specifically avoid eating GM.
This is war.
This is big.
This is wonderful.
This is America starts labeling GMOs and not waiting for the FDA.
Well, FDA, the USDA, they could give a crap about us.
They are actually mandated to promote biotechnology, and so there's no way that they are going to.
Well, the USDA actually owns some of the patents, percentages of patents on this stuff.
Absolutely.
They're in private enterprise business, folks.
Absolutely. And the recently indicted former commissioner of the FDA said, when he was giving a presentation on the FDA to a dairy conference years ago, he said the two purposes of the FDA, to have safe food and drugs and to promote biotechnology. So it's not a hidden agenda, it's an overt agenda. So we will be basically turning our thumbs, turning our noses up at the laws and saying we're going to do our own bit. Now, here's the announcement. On Friday, I spoke and gave this bigger picture, but as part of this picture, we need to define what non-GMO means, because there's going to be some, obviously, some low level of contamination that has to be allowable, because you can't certify it as zero. It's just not practical. So we have identified a specific standard and a method of verification. It's called the Non-GMO Project, and we announced it with support from Whole Foods, from United Natural Foods, which is the largest natural food distributor in the country, from Eden Foods, which is very large, and also from Lundberg Family Farms. And there's also other products, other companies that are also supporting it and wanting to put their products through right away.
Terrific.
So basically, we have wide-scale support from the natural food industry on a clean-out process of genetic engineering.
Stand together or be cut to ribbons, folks. That's it. It's time. It's time. Yeah. Wonderful. This is big, big news. And this is going to be taken very careful notice of by big farm business corporations, which are going to fight this every step of the way. My feeling, I'm sorry to say this, I honestly believe there will be, and there probably already has, but we know in the case of Percy Schmeiser, it's highly suspicious, intentionally fouling of of GM-free crops by these big companies. They'll be hiring hitmen to go out and pollute and contaminate fields with GM seeds and all kinds of that. I think this is going to be a war. I'm not kidding.
Well, let me tell you, let's return the channel to contamination for a few minutes.
Right.
And then come back to you wanted to talk about the health dangers, and I'll be happy to give you some more stuff we didn't cover last month.
Good.
A friend of mine, Phil Barriano, was debating on television in South Africa a number of years ago with the number two person at AID, which is an aid organization that gives aid to Africa, and they very much have been promoting the biotech agenda. And after the cameras were off, they continued to debate. It got kind of heated. And at one point, this woman said, "You just wait. There's going to be so much GM corn planted in South Africa that no one in Africa can plant pure non-GM." And so she basically tipped the hand.
Got it.
Her intention was to contaminate. And this was made very clear when there was a number of countries that were receiving GM food aid in the form of corn due to a famine in southern Africa. And they realized it was genetically engineered. And so they first said, no, we don't want genetically engineered corn. The U.S. refused and said, eat it or starve. And so two countries said, well, can you at least mill the corn so that our farmers can plant it, which would, you know, infiltrate our biodiversity and contaminate. And the U.S. said no to that. Their intention was to contaminate. And so South Africa came in and they milled it, and so it was distributed. But Zambia came through and said, absolutely not. We will not. They sent out a fact-finding team to Europe and the United States and said, this stuff is just too dangerous for us to feed to our people.
By the way, we've got a break here, but let me hold on to your thought. Zambia, too dangerous to feed to our people. Zambia is doing some remarkably intelligent agriculture. I happen to know this from another guest, Jan Lamprecht. In all of Africa, southern Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, Zambia, I think, if I remember correctly, is leading the way in some very important areas. This, of course, is one. Be right back with Jeffrey Smith's Seeds of Deception update in just a minute. Jeffrey Smith is our guest tonight. His monthly update, Seeds of Deception, is his website, and I hope you'll all click on his name and go there. We're talking about, briefly, the obvious, clearly stated intent to genetically pollute all basic agriculture in Africa and everywhere else. We don't have to draw the line anywhere. This is as far as they can reach, folks are going to spread this crap. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I'll give another example of their intentional co-mixing. Canola can blow pollen and seeds a great distance, and it's primarily cross-pollinated with bees, which travel 2-3 miles. And there's been a resistance in Australia to putting genetically engineered canola because the states believe that it could hurt their export markets. Of course it'll hurt their export markets. The U.S. has lost, you know, billions of dollars in export markets. They're spending $3 to $5 billion extra per year in extra price subsidies. Yeah. To boost prices of products that no one wants, and the national government of Australia has been co-opted by Monsanto and others to think, oh yeah, we need GM crops or we'll be falling behind. But the state said, no, we're going to impose a moratorium because of economic reasons. But here was the proposal by Monsanto and others. They wanted to have dozens of small field trials of canola with a buffer zone of 5 meters away from non-GM.
Oh, all that much, huh? 5 meters.
Yes, that was generous of them, wasn't it?
Gee.
I mean, this was such a blatant plan to contaminate the canola supply so that they would just give up.
Yep.
In fact, one insider from the biotech industry said it's the plan of the biotechnology industry to have so much out there and so much contamination, you just give up. Now, we have some news today, very good news today. A judge ordered an immediate halt to the sales of genetically modified alfalfa seed by Monsanto. And the reason is that a month ago, the federal judge ruled that they had let this perennial genetically modified new variety go out without proper investigation into the environmental possibilities of contamination.
Uh-huh.
And this was big. They said the USDA had violated the law, had not exerted proper care in requiring this environmental study.
So
very, very good news today is that the judge in Oregon said there will be no selling of genetically modified alfalfa seed from this point forward until the proper due diligence is done. Now, if some of it's already out of the bag, one person estimated about 5% of alfalfa in the United States is now genetically engineered since 2005, but it's still, you know, I think we've stopped it at least for the time being.
Right. I hope next month you're not reporting the judge was removed.
Right.
Jeez.
Right. Now, there was another contamination thing announced in August where Bayer Crop Science had genetically engineered a rice variety and had field tested it in 2001 as the last time it was officially planted. But in August of 2006, the USDA said, oops, it appears to have contaminated the long-grain U.S. rice supply, but no problem, it's not a problem. Well, it was a problem. It, you know, Japan closed its doors to the
at-risk. Just a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, I mean, within 2 days, the rice futures market dropped $150 million. Just a little bit of a problem. And it turns out, you know, they now have to certify rice as non-GM in order to send it to Europe. Japan closed its doors. It was, and this thing happened with corn, with an unproved variety of corn, a year earlier when the USDA had information starting from December. But they held it. They kept it hidden for 4 months. And then Nature magazine
Who kept it hidden?
The United States government was told by Syngenta that, oops, we had an experimental, unapproved variety of genetically modified corn, which hadn't been introduced and had last been field trialed 4 years earlier. And, oops, it's in the U.S. corn supply. So they told the U.S. government in December, and in late March, they still hadn't done anything, and it was leaked to Nature magazine. And Nature magazine called the USDA and said, we understand that there is a variety, BT10, that has contaminated. And when they did that, all of a sudden it forced the government to admit it. And they said, oh, we were working on the plan. We hadn't announced it yet because we were working on a program to make sure it was safe, but it's completely safe. And again, they lost millions of dollars in sending corn varieties to Japan. They blocked 14 shipments by the end of the year. So the contamination happens. I mean, if you think about Hawaii, it was pure lava rock years ago. Now it is a lush tropical paradise, but it's 2,000 miles, more than 2,000 miles away from the nearest mainland. Uh-huh. Where did it get those seeds?
Uh-huh.
Nature has a way of spreading her bounty, whether it's seed transport or pollen transport. And so we're putting the products of this infant science into the environment where it can never be recalled and feeding it to millions of people. So the contamination issue, the self-propagating genetic pollution from genetically engineered crops, makes it such that it will outlive the effects of global warming. It can. It can outlive the nuclear waste issue. It can outlive anything that we're doing right now. Decisions we're making now in the laboratory and putting it out there can possibly be with the species for as long as the species exists.
For as long as the species exists. At this rate, folks, we're dialing in disaster with GM. We're going to talk after the break in just a minute here about some of the dangers that we already know are occurring and manifesting themselves in our bodies from this crap. Stand by. I'll be right back with Jeffrey Smith and more. All right, back to Jeffrey Smith, talking about the genetic modification of our world, not just our crops. And again, there is no chance that these people are going to sit back and allow the natural foods industry to really mount a major attack and capture of much of the intelligent consuming public. Not going to happen. They'll fight back with everything they have. They'll play dirty. They already are playing dirty. You heard what Jeff Smith said about South Africa. The same thing will go here. Ask Percy Schmeiser about the ethics and the legal system when your crops become contaminated with a Monsanto GM seed and you're wiped out. Guess what happened? You know what happened if you've heard the story, but guess what will happen to the next person? Same thing. The precedent has been set. Go ahead, Jeff. Let's just keep rolling along here. This is
okay.
Let's
shift over to the health risks because, you know, last month we talked about how the FDA scientists who had warned of serious dangers were overturned by the political appointee who was Monsanto's former attorney. We talked about how eating genetically engineered corn chips, which produce pesticides in every bite, could theoretically turn your intestinal flora into living pesticide factories.
No, this is Shades of Aspartame with Don Rumsfeld way back when.
Yes, right. We also talked about how we can get antibiotic-resistant diseases, how Arthur Andersen Consulting revealed that Monsanto's intention was to genetically engineer 100% of the commercial seed supply of the world, and that thousands of pigs and cows developed false pregnancies or became sterile, linked to genetically modified corn varieties, that BT cotton problems caused thousands of suicides in India. And so we gave a little bit of the information about the health risks. But I started at the top of the hour talking about a man who was gagged. And let's talk about his specific situation, because it ties in with what you talk about in terms of the pushback by the industry. The UK said that they wanted to actually implement long-term safety testing protocol as a requirement for all genetically engineered crops before they were approved. And so they put out a $3 million grant, and 28 different scientists or groups applied, and they gave it to Arpad Pusztai, the world's leading expert in his field, who worked at the top nutritional research lab, one of the top ones in the world. And so he worked with a 20-member research team over three different institutes to develop a testing protocol, and as part of that he developed a potato genetically engineered to produce a harmless-to-mammals pesticide. This pesticide would kill insects but not hurt mammals, supposedly. Mm. So he genetically engineered this and then fed it to rats, and he fed other rats just the plain potato and other rats the potato spiked with this insecticide. And all the rats also had a complete balanced diet. So it turns out only the rats that ate the genetically engineered potato got sick. They had potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system. And these signs of this occurred in 10 days. Because they sacrificed the rats both at 10 days and 110 days, and in both cases they show these things. And I've seen the pictures of the guts. It's absolutely astounding. The double the size of the walls of the stomach and the intestine.
Oh, man.
Now, what happened was the rats that were fed the potatoes that were spiked with the same insecticide that the genetically engineered potatoes were engineered to produce did not cause these problems. So it wasn't the insecticide that caused the problem. What was the problem? The process of genetically engineering a crop causes massive collateral damage in the DNA. What you do is you take cells and you clone them and grow them that way, which causes massive mutations. You blast in with a gene gun a foreign gene, which can cause all sorts of insertional mutations. Uh-huh. Essentially, if you compare the before and after genetic engineering, 2-4% or more of the DNA has been mutated as a result of this process. In one case, they found a single insertion also changed the expression levels of 5% of the genes. Certain genes are destroyed completely. Others are cut in half. Some are turned off permanently. Some are turned on permanently. It's like genetic roulette.
This is incredible. And that's after one insertion?
Yes. One insertion.
Man.
And so he used the same process that was used to put the other products, other genetically modified products in the market, and he discovered this massive problem. So he was invited around the same time he discovered the damage to the rats to go on TV and talk about genetic engineering. With permission from his director, he was able to speak just very superficially about his research because it hadn't been published yet. But all hell broke loose when he did. For 2 days, the press just swamped the Institute, and the director actually took over the press activities himself, saying this would be a great opportunity to get money for the Institute. But then, 2 days later, there were two phone calls allegedly placed from the UK Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to that same director. The next morning, Arpad Pusztai was fired from his job after 35 years and silenced with threats of a lawsuit. The 20-member research team was disbanded. They did not implement the long-term safety testing protocol, and the Institute started putting out immediately statements that tried to damage the reputation of Arpad Pusztai and limit the damage that had already been done to the reputation of genetic engineering.
You just remember, this is no accident, folks. This is highest level, and they don't care about us. They do not care about us at all.
There was one person at the Institute who said that he had heard that Monsanto had called Clinton, and Clinton had called Blair, and Blair's office had called the director. I haven't gotten confirmation on it, but it's the kind of thing
sounds
that happens.
Sounds logical.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What happened was they completely put out this huge disinformation about this research, and then after 7 months, Arpad Pusztai was invited to speak before Parliament. He got his data back. It was peer-reviewed by 23 scientists who said it was absolutely, clear science showing damage due to genetic engineering. And it's now in the Lancet published. But I asked Dr. Pusztai, I said, what was your most shocking moment? And he said it wasn't actually being fired. It wasn't discovering the damage to the rat. It was actually a few months earlier. He was still in good standing, the pro-GM scientist working with his team, and the director walked into his office with a stack of about 700 pages, and these were the six or seven submissions from the biotech companies to the committee that approved GM crops for the UK. And the director was on that committee with 11 others. And he said, the Minister of Agriculture is meeting in Brussels to have a vote on genetic engineering and wants a scientific opinion on these things. And they gave him 2.5 hours to do it. Now, when Arpad said, reading those studies was the most shocking moment because, well, we'll tell you why, I guess, after the break.
Great timing. Perfect.
Yes.
All right, stand by. I hope all of you will listen to this program again and share it with others. You need to know that this is being done. This is being orchestrated, demanded, implemented from the highest levels of power. These people do not care about our health and welfare at all. Back in a minute. Okay, back with Jeffrey Smith, and this has been, again, extremely informative, and it should be extremely alarming to all of you. And I need you to support this movement to genetically modify by label. We've got a GM label everything. Everything. You have a right to know. It's simple. This cover-up is as bad or worse than the aspartame cover-up. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, we last left Dr. Arpad Pusztai reading.
Yeah, you were rehabilitating him.
Yes, he was reading the studies by the industry that they had used to submit to get their products approved. And he knew that he was going to give his answers in response to a minister of agriculture meeting in Brussels. And he said this was the most shocking moment in his life because he realized the research that was done on genetically engineered foods by biotech companies was so poor, so superficial, so flimsy, and these were his words. He said, I realized at that point that that what I was doing and what they were doing was diametrically opposed. I was doing safety studies, and they were doing as little as possible to get their foods on the market as quickly as possible.
Of course.
He said it was a turning point in his life.
I'll
so
bet.
He called the minister up and said, I wasn't planning to give you a strong recommendation after only 2.5 hours, but I have to say there's certainly not enough information to allow these foods to be fed to human beings. The minister said, I don't know why you're telling me that. Your director's committee approved these foods 2 years ago. They're already on the market.
Huh.
They just wanted a scientific opinion from someone who actually read it, because iPod actually knew that the 12 members of the committee would never read the 700 pages. They were committee men, they were busy men, and they did not have, they were not working scientists.
Got it.
He had created the protocol, was working on a protocol that was going to be implemented to the European Union. He was among the most competent people on earth to review these studies,
yes.
And he completely denounced it.
Yeah.
Now, what does it mean? It means that if the potatoes that he, the genetically engineered potatoes that he fed to his rats that caused this massive damage to virtually every organ and system that was studied, those potatoes would have made it onto the market if they had been subjected to the same superficial studies that had been used to get the soy and corn on the market. However, what is worse is this, that the soy and corn that is on the market that we're eating every day unless we're paying attention, is created from the same process that he used to create the potato.
Sure.
And might be creating the same organ damage and the same immune system. Yes.
Why not? Why wouldn't it be? We don't know.
We don't know.
Who the hell's doing the testing?
Now, Jeff, I'm thinking around this time, we need to talk about how to avoid eating GMOs even before our non-GMO shopping.
We do. We can't trust the USDA organic label, so what do we trust?
Well, I would say organic has been a trusted oasis of non-GM. It's not, you know, it's not going to be 100%. There's going to be some tiny amount.
Well, they changed it, as you know, excuse me, but they changed it to where you only have to have 25% organic to qualify as being able to wear that label on your can or your package, that little green or white label.
Actually, I had thought it was still the 70, 95, and 100 three split. I'll do some research on that.
70?
Well, there's three different levels of organic. There's what if you depending on your label if you
but
say,
it's not pure. That I guess that's the bigger point here we should focus on. It's not, it doesn't have to be 100% organic to wear that label, correct?
Well, you see, if it's you have three choices when you get certified, as far as I understand.
Okay.
At least this was certainly the case when I did the research on it. It may have changed, and that is you can label yourself 100% organic.
Okay.
You can label yourself organic.
I've seen those labels, but I've also been told by two people, professional farmers, that the feds changed it. You don't. I think it's 75% organic. That's what it is qualify for the.
There's a third level. You can say like made with organic canola, or made with organic such and such. And
all right.
And then if that's the case, then 70% have to be organic, but everything in the all ingredients have to be non-GMO.
Okay, I got you. All right. Go ahead.
So I describe it on my website seedsofdeception.com. How to avoid eating GMOs. By the way, I also want to mention, when we talk next month, my new book will be out, which is now being available for pre-orders on the website. It's called Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods. I worked for the last 2 years getting input from more than 30 scientists, putting all the known health risks, all the adverse reactions on GM into two-page spreads, 65 two-page spreads with an executive summary on the left, detailed cited text on the right, so that you can just flip through if you're the kind of scanning person, or you can dive into the details if you want to do that. And there's 1,000 end notes for those that want to go there. So it gives the lightweight reader or the in-depth scientist an opportunity to understand the massive problems related to GM. It also shows that the government regulations are not competent to identify and protect us from the risks. It also shows in great detail how industry-funded studies are rigged to avoid finding problems. And I just have an advanced reading copies right now, but around April 1st it'll be available. So if anyone does a pre-order, we'll do some free shipping for you before April 1st.
Great.
That's at seedsofdeception.com. But on that site you can also see how to avoid buying GMOs. And I'm going to tell you also, because if you've been listening about these rat studies, that's the most popular question that I get all the time is, how do I stop feeding it to kids? How do I stop eating it?
Sure.
So there's three choices. You can buy organic. You can buy products that say non-GMO, and we're going to be making that third-party verified very soon. Or you can avoid soy, corn, cotton, and canola, which are the four major GM crops. Now, there's also Hawaiian papaya. There's a little bit of zucchini and crookneck squash. But the main four are soy, corn, cottonseed and canola. Now, cottonseed and canola are used for oils like vegetable oils.
See them all the time.
Yes, but for soy and corn, you have also soy lecithin, high fructose corn syrup, soy and corn flour. So you basically there's a little shopping guide on my site already that needs to be updated, but you can click to it, that has by brand which brands. But if you happen to be picking up, let's say, tomato sauce and you happen to buy Ragu, well, the Ragu Chunky has soybean oil and high fructose corn syrup. The Ragu Light has only olive oil. So you have to be able to read the labels to resort what your brands are so that you don't have to be part of this massive experiment.
I've been asking for someone to put a shopper's guide to label reading together for years.
Yes.
Just, I mean, it's simple. You go through the names. You can't pronounce it. You look it up in the guide. It could be in a little tiny handheld computer or something, whatever, and it'll tell you what it is. You decide if you want to eat it.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Maybe we should have it so we can scan it.
That'd
actually, we should have a situation where you just enter the product name and get the whole background
That's
on it.
That's right. Agreed.
Now, I also want to mention that there's a free newsletter on my site. I've stopped doing it for 3 months while I was finishing the book, but it started again this month. And also a free download of an hour-long lecture. So if you like what you heard and you want to send it to people, you can send them a link or download it on your iPod or whatever. My institute tries to put out as much information in all these different forms as possible so that we can reach the tipping point together in the United States as consumers, protecting ourselves and protecting our kids. There's an excerpt from my video, Hidden Dangers in Kids' Meals, on the site that you're welcome to use and throw it up on YouTube. I mean, basically, we can't wait for the government to protect us on this thing. We can't wait for research. We have a chance.
We can't wait. Forget ever waiting for the government to protect us. Not going to happen.
I think that's a safe.
That's my cynical view, but I'll put my money on it.
Well, I've watched very carefully how they're handling the GM issue over the last 10 years, and it's absolutely abysmal and dangerous and criminal, in my opinion.
In fact, totally.
It was clear fraud in the FDA when this was put forward, when they denied the warnings of scientists.
It's the same with aspartame, and you listeners know, we've covered this for many, many years. The same thing happened when the scientists said this is a toxin, we don't want formaldehyde, formic acid, diketopiperazine, methyl alcohol. We don't want that in the body.
Aspartame is genetically engineered. They genetically engineers the microorganism to help make it more cheaply. And it also had the manipulation of Donald Rumsfeld, et cetera, like we see.
Sure.
With GM, you have this kind of revolving door where the former EPA administrator went up to Monsanto's board, the former U.S. trade ambassador went to Monsanto's board, someone else from Monsanto became the EPA top person.
Musical chairs, folks.
Yes, yes. And Clarence Thomas from the Supreme Court was a Monsanto attorney.
Yep. I think only you and I are the only people who haven't been Monsanto board members. We'll get there, though, someday, probably. This is all sickening. It's all amazing. You're going to be with us the second Monday of each month, if your schedule permits. Otherwise, we'll move you.
I think next month we're on for the 25th of April.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. Okay, April 25th. That's right. I've got you the second Monday, but we've got to move you. Okay. April 25th, we're there, and that's good. Now, we got just about a minute and a half left. Let's let the people know what you have available on your website. You got some fabulous information.
Okay, seedsofdeception.com. We have the newsletter, the monthly newsletter, How to Avoid Eating GMOs. We have a campaign. I'm going to give you a different email, a different website now.
Okay.
GMfreeschools.org. GM Free Schools. We have a whole campaign. I mean, if you want to do something and you're just bubbling because of this knowledge, then going with the school issue is so easy. We have a 60-page manual. We have a DVD which causes instant activism. You just show it to a group of people, and a lot of people get excited and join the campaign. It works every time. We have you get your own website, your own listserv, so gmfreeschools.org or seedsofdeception.com. You can also pick up Seeds of Deception. You can pick up Genetic Roulette.
Sure.
You can pick up the DVD, the audio, You're Eating What? Stop Eating Genetically Engineered Foods, and please copy this for your friends. An audio CD, which you can download direct.
Again, to let the people know, there is a new movement now, which we're going to support every step of the way, to enable all of you people to understand when you are eating GM foods, or hopefully when you can choose not to, and
right.
teach you how to do that.
Campaign for Healthier Eating in America, which we started, and I'll remind you again next month and how you
okay.
can help.
Good. Thanks. See you next month. Thanks, Jeff, very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Jeffrey Smith, seedsofdeception.com. Fabulous book, incredible information, pretty scary stuff, but all true. All right, we're going to pause and be right back. Okay, welcome back. We're going to do something very cosmic now for the next 2 hours. We'd like to do as many things as possible on this stage, this platform, this venue we provide to you 5 nights a week, year in and year out. And tonight's no exception. We're going above and out there. But in the same fashion, we're actually going right down here and within. My first guest tonight is Don Scott. Scientist Wal Thornhill will join us in an hour. We're going to continue our conversation with Wal, live from Australia. Don Scott is a PhD. He received his doctorate in electrical engineering at the Worcester Polytechnic University Institute in Massachusetts and was a member of the faculty of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Massachusetts Amherst from 1959 until his retirement in 1998. During that time, he was the recipient of several major Good Teaching Awards. He's the author of a 730-page book on circuit analysis, and his paper on electricity in space is scheduled for publication in the journal Transactions on Plasma Science later this year. His book is called The Electric Sky. That will be the subject we're going to talk to him most specifically about. The overall subject, of course, is the electric universe, which is being championed by Wal Thornhill, certainly Don Scott, and our friend and colleague Dave Talbot. And Dave Talbot, by the way, is listening right now, and thanks, Dave, for helping put these two gentlemen together. We've spent many, many wonderful hours with David Talbot and Wal Thornhill over the years talking about the electric universe and how the skies above the Earth, the stars, were much different in ancient times than they are now, and how that explains many of the things that are more than enigmatic to scientists and researchers and historians today. Welcome to the program, Don.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. The book, The Electric Sky, has gotten some really wonderful endorsements. Let me just read a couple of them. Garrett L. Verschuer. Did I pronounce it right?
It's Jarrett. It's a soft G. Jarrett Verschuer, yeah.
Now, look, this is funny. I got the Verschuer right, and this is, but I didn't get Jarrett.
That's right.
All right, it's Verschuer.
Right.
Now,
correct.
How many people would get Verschuer?
Well, you know, you got half it right. So
I got the back end right, and never mind. All right. Well, Garrett is now Jarrett. And so Jarrett Verschuer, PhD, said, I really love this book. It's causing me to rethink a great deal of my own work. I am convinced that The Electric Sky deserves the widest possible readership. I felt genuine excitement while reading the book and felt I was delving into a delicious feast of new ideas. They don't come any better than that.
No, they don't. That's why I put it on the back cover.
That's a wonderful
book. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Louis E. Franks. Got that one right.
Yes. Yeah.
Lewis, it's tough to mess Lewis up.
Right.
Out of Stanford says, you don't have to be an astronomer to enjoy this book. It's an exciting story about how a small group of physicists, engineers, and other scientists have challenged the establishment, the big science astronomers, who are reluctant, that is a kind word, to listen to anyone outside their own elite circle. Reluctant is being charitable. It's like running into a brick wall.
You're quite right.
And Tim Eastman, Ph.D., also head of Raytheon's. Now, you know, all of our listeners, Don, are very sharp, and many of them understand right away when we say Raytheon, we're talking about the most advanced, often black budget types of types of work that is being done continually. Tim Eastman, Ph.D., head of Raytheon's Space Physics and Astrophysics groups, well known for his work on the magnetospheric boundary layers and the initial discovery of the low latitude boundary layer, said gravity was the focus of 20th century astronomy. For the 21st century, it will be electromagnetism and plasmas in addition. So we have a very interesting mix of things to consider tonight. Gravity, which I would say 99.9% of the walking on this planet really don't understand at all. And then we have electromagnetism, electricity, if you will, and plasmas, which also 99.9% of the people don't really understand. If you had to ask them to define it, you'd be met with probably blank stares or...
I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, my friend. Tell us about the electric sky, what it's about, and then we'll get into more specifics.
Well, it's a kind of a tough topic to cover in an hour. There'll be an exam at the end of the program, right?
You got it.
Essentially, I think the main thing that people should understand is what a plasma really is. The word plasma means lots of different things to lots of different people. It's also synonymous with a ghost. You know, you see a ghost, and oh, it was a plasma. That's not the kind of plasma we're talking about.
True, and they do refer to that as ectoplasma.
Exactly,
still a plasma.
Yeah, and of course it's blood plasma, and that's again not what we're talking about. But the plasma we're talking about, usually, if you want to differentiate it from those other types, we call it electric plasma, is really simply a gas. That has the atoms of the gas have been at least partially ionized, and that what that word means is clearly an atom is consists of a center made up of protons and neutrons and some electrons flying around an equal number of electrons flying around the outside. Mm-hmm. If you pop one of those electrons loose, and it's able to move through space. It's a charge, and it's a charge carrier. And if you can get a charge to move, that's an electric current. So the most obvious plasma for folks to realize is the sign that hangs in the window. It says "Eat at Joe's," you know, Schlitz.
Yeah.
drink Blatt's beer. All those neon signs, so called, have plasma inside of them. But actually, the fluorescent tubes. You're not seeing plasma in a fluorescent tube as you do in the neon sign, but there's nevertheless a plasma in there. And, of course, lightning is a plasma.
Right. I have experience with plasmas also, which some of our listeners may be familiar with. I do a lot of research with Rife instruments, energy through electromedicine, if you will.
Okay.
And the two applications are most obviously the glass handles or glass tubes you hold in your hands, and then there's a little computer that... It generates the various Hertz frequencies which come through those tubes. In those tubes are a combination of five noble gases. And they're invisible, of course, except when the machine is functional. And then those noble gases are turned into a plasma state, and they turn a beautiful, it's a lavender magenta, kind of a pink color.
Yeah.
And
well,
it's a plasma state.
Well, plasma actually has three different steady-state operating conditions, operating modes, you might say. One is dark. And you don't see anything. And the perfect example of that is the ionosphere of Earth. You can go out there on a dark winter's night and look up, and you don't see anything glowing unless there's an aurora.
Fascinating. I didn't know that.
So, but there's charge up there, and the proof of it is we're able to conduct radio communication, let's say intercontinentally from the East Coast across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe, by bouncing radio waves off of that ionospheric layer. And the ionospheric layer is not glowing. It's in the dark mode.
I see.
And then if you have enough electrical excitation, you can have an aurora, which, of course, you see. That's a glow mode.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what the E to Joe's sign is. It's a glow mode plasma.
Well, we've had some amazing pictures recently of auroras.
Absolutely.
They are. Boy, if that doesn't strike one dumb with awe, nothing will. Some of those things are just incredible.
Right.
We also have, of course, I've spent almost 12, 13 years talking about the HARP project up in Alaska and other such, but primarily HARP, which pumps up a tremendous amount of electric energy into the ionosphere, charging it up, and then they do things with it. So we have that. And if you get a chance, I would suggest going to, take a look at Rentz.com. The top featured story, it's a blue box. It's simply entitled Weather Mod for Weather Modification, which we think is being done on a number of fronts by the military and others. And I've just there's a picture there of a perfect hole in the sky with a strange cloud formation in the middle of it. And I was able to put that up there, and it certainly created a lot of interest. Earlier tonight, one of our colleagues sent in another picture which is virtually identical to that particular hole in the sky. And it's an older picture. It's not the same one. It's the same phenomenon, and it is clearly indicative of some kind of electromagnetic charge being pumped into the I don't know what level it would be, but it's probably 25, 35,000 feet. I don't know how the clouds are in terms of elevation there, but Mark Gaffney sent that in. It's on Tom Bearden's website, and we're going to post that to Rentz.com shortly. So there'll be two identical, weird cloud holes that you'll see, and we are submitting that those are electromagnetically caused somehow, maybe by some plasma state or not, but probably by HARP or some other kind of weather modification device, which is playing with that ionosphere, which, as you made quite clear, is a dark plasma.
Yep.
So because they're using it to bounce, basically.
Well, there's plenty of natural charge up there. You may be referring to a man-made supplying of power to that charge.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but in any case, it's up there and it's usable and it's apparently quite a tool.
Yeah.
That's what they're finding out. So stand by. I'll be right back with Don Scott to find out about the other two kinds of plasmas. Many of you have seen pictures of UFOs, by the way, and they're surrounded with kind of a fuzziness, as it were. And we suspect that fuzziness could be some kind of a plasma state created by the drive mechanism of these craft that are flying around all over the place. Back in just a couple minutes. Don Scott. How was that for a musical intro, Don?
That's very good.
Yeah. All right, we rolled out the orchestra for you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Plasma number one, dark state ionosphere. Okay.
Yeah. Number two would be the what's called normal glow mode. And as I say, that's the neon sign kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the aurora. Also, the sun's corona actually is a glow mode plasma. Interesting about the thing about the aurora, the prior to about 1900, people, of course, had seen the aurora for hundreds of years. They wondered at it. They didn't know what it was. They thought
it had to be just incredible to ancient cultures.
Absolutely, yeah.
The gods playing in the heaven, whatever.
Precisely.
You know.
If you wave a bedsheet at it, can you move it? You know,
there
that
you
kind
go.
Of thing. So, but there was a Norwegian scientist whose name was Christian Birkeland, who went out there and under the northern lights and took measurements and finally discovered that actually the cause of the aurora was electric currents coming from the sun all the way 93 million miles from the sun to the Earth and exciting the plasma in the upper atmosphere electrically. And when he announced that, he was laughed at by most astronomers. They said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, you got a stream of charge, let's say a stream of electrons traveling 93 million miles. I mean, they would electrons repel each other. The stream would disperse. It would never hold together.
Yeah.
It's like dropping a drop of ink in a glass of water. It would just diffuse. And
they said it was a local phenomenon.
It was a tidal phenomenon in the atmosphere. Birkeland, turns out, was right. And the reason he was right is because the entire solar interplanetary space is a very diffuse plasma itself. People talk about the solar wind, and what they're talking about is this flow of plasma from the sun outward. And it turns out it's a very good electrical conductor, almost like a transmission line. So
now you said something. Excuse my interruption again here. This is fascinating, and I'm going to put this up tonight. Someone sent me a story, and you well know that high voltage lines, which millions of people drive underneath every day on the freeway or on roads, whatever, those huge high voltage lines, put out tremendous fields of electromagnetic energy around them. Huge.
Yes.
That's why if you have your AM radio on, you drive under one, it just goes total static.
Absolutely.
Okay, now, this fellow in Europe, I'm going to get the story, it's fascinating. He took regular fluorescent light tubes, 4 or 5 feet long, stuck them in the ground, hundreds of them, underneath high voltage lines, which have to be 100 feet, 150 feet up in the air. And every night, every one of those tubes would light up.
Oh, sure. That's easily explainable. I mean, because the power line is a couple of hundred thousand, maybe even, well, in Sweden, maybe in other locations too, up to a million volts. And, a million volts will reach out halfway to grab you. So
there you go. That's why EMF is not good for you. And in Sweden, they won't allow an elementary school within 400 meters of any high voltage line.
Yeah. Well, that argument goes on. I mean, I've seen both sides of that story.
It's a big one. I understand.
I will tell you, I would not have a house underneath one. I know a lot of people. The guy who was the agent for my first book lived right directly underneath a 300,000 volt powered line.
Is he still with us?
I'm not sure.
He probably glowed all night too.
That's right. No,
the other funny part about that analogy is very quickly they went in Israel. A news crew dressed up as a construction crew and went up and knocked on the door of a guy who owned one of the major cell phone companies there and said that they were going to be erecting a cell phone transmission tower just down the block from his house. And the guy went berserk.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "No, you're not. I'll take you to court." In other words, the answer is to the question, why? Because they're dangerous.
Well, the other side will claim that the magnetic fields that you get in your head are not of a sufficient strength to ionize anything. If it can't ionize anything, then it can't hurt you. Well, the question is, is ionization necessary to cause change of any kind?
No, and it's not, and I'll tell you why, and you know why, but let me just tell it for our listeners. The reason, folks, you may not be ionizing things in your body, but that every cell in your body spends a tremendous amount of energy trying to delicately balance the positive and negative charge balance in its cellular membrane.
Absolutely.
And when you have this unmitigated, unadulterated, absolute free-flowing surge of electrons, of random photons, if you will, coming off an AC power line, they go through the body and they degrade each cell. They cause each cell to fight to maintain its cellular, magnetic, electromagnetic equilibrium, and that drags the whole body's immune system down, et cetera. And,
disturbs the IM pump. Yeah, right. Well, anyway, just one last thing. The last type of plasma, just for completeness, is the arc mode, and that one is pretty familiar if you've ever seen an electric arc welding machine. That's an electric arc. Lightning, of course, is an electric arc. And if you scuff your feet across the rug on a winter day and reach out to the doorknob, zap, it's an arc as well.
Tesla and Dr. Frankenstein knew all about
exactly.
that as well.
The Jacob's Ladder,
yeah. Yeah. We'll be pausing just for a couple minutes, Don, and be right back with you. Great pleasure to talk to Don Scott tonight. And do check out his book. Click on his name at Rents.com. And we shall continue. Okay, and we're back with Mr. Don Scott. All right, Don, go ahead, please.
Well, where are we?
We've talked about the three kinds of plasma, and I think we all have a pretty good understanding of that. And this goes right into the face of physics and astrophysics as people the mainstream likes to embrace and hold. So let's pick it up there. Why is it so hard? What are you doing that upsets people so much, except those who are truly scientific in their view of the cosmos?
That's the silver dollar question. I have no idea why these ideas of the electrical nature of space, we've had to fight tooth and nail from 1900, from the time of Birkeland, up through, Irving Langmuir won the Nobel Prize. He was the guy who coined the word plasma.
Uh-huh.
And the reason he used it, he borrowed it, you might say stole it from blood plasma, in that, everybody knows, if you have an impurity gets into your blood cells immediately surround it and try to isolate it and stop it from doing any damage. And the same thing happens in plasma. If you insert a foreign particle into a plasma, a surrounding sheath called a double layer sheath will form around that foreign particle. And after Langmuir, there was a man by the name of Hannes Alfvén who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1970, and he's really the father of plasma cosmology. So what we're discussing here tonight is really not, any new science or anything paranormal. It's really hard science, and it's just that it seems as though there is an inertia or a not invented here syndrome in astronomy that, well, we've done very nicely, thank you very much, with just using visible light, and we don't need these electrical ideas. Well, it turns out they do, and if they would admit that there is an electrical aspect to the cosmos, they wouldn't have to invent these crazy things that they've invented.
Explanations for them.
Yeah, like black holes and the neutron stars and missing matter and string theory.
It's really a simpler picture, isn't it, than that?
Much, much simpler. Exactly.
And so the vast vacuum of space is teeming with things.
Absolutely.
Tell us what those things are.
Charge. Essentially are the nuclei of helium atoms, a couple of protons, and somewhere in the vicinity, a few meters away, perhaps, the electrons that got popped out of that originally
uh-huh.
neutral atom.
So space is anything but empty.
Oh, anything but. It's like Dr. Anthony Peratt, who was a good friend of mine, who was just recently retired as one of the directors of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, was a student of Hannes Alfvén. And he has a book in which is pretty much the Bible now of the mathematical basis for plasma cosmology. And in there he talks about the density of charges in space. And as I recall, there's something like 1 or 2 or up to 10, depending on where you are, charges per cubic centimeter in interplanetary space.
Per cubic centimeter.
That's a tiny little thing. So there are literally maybe a million in a cubic meter.
Right.
And if you think about how many cubic miles there are in the volume, let's say, between the Earth and the Sun,
uh-huh.
there's trillion, trillion, trillions of them. So, yes, chock-a-block full of that.
Uncountable numbers.
Exactly.
And there is certainly, within physics that we do not yet understand fully, the means to use that energy, not only out there, but probably down here.
Well, we see it happening. For example, the gravity, which is what most astronomers limit themselves to. Most classical astronomers agree that there's gravity out there, it's at work, and they are now reluctantly admitting there are magnetic fields out there because we have radio telescopes that show us that they do exist out there.
Yeah.
But insofar as, well, are there electric currents out there? Well, there may be, but they don't do anything. That's what you'll hear from standard astronomers. Well, what we're seeing are these huge, maybe you're familiar with them, these huge jets of energy being expelled from the centers of active galaxies, like secret galaxies.
Yes, incredible pictures.
There's just a very simple answer. Gravity only attracts. Electromagnetism, both magnetic fields and electric fields, both attract and repel. So when you see matter being spurted out in a stream, in a jet, from a galaxy, it's very difficult to explain that repulsion by gravity, which is a mechanism which can only attract stuff together. So the way classic astronomers have now tried to explain that, those jets, is by saying, well, that's Hawking radiation, named after Stephen Hawking. There must be a black hole in the middle of that galaxy, and it sucks matter into the black hole and then spurts it out again. Well,
oh,
why?
Please.
Is it indigestion?
What
is
do they do? Yeah, exactly. Cosmic gas.
Exactly. Exactly.
I can't believe this. I mean, these people are, well, there won't be any accountability in 10, 20, 30, 40 years when this stuff is left in the dustbin where it ought to be, these kinds of explanations.
I hope so, but you know, it took Galileo for how long? From 1620 to and late in the 1900s for the church to admit that maybe he had something there, that Copernicus was right and the sun really was the middle of the solar system and not the Earth.
Well, let's hope it doesn't take that long.
Yeah,
now, just not to get into any esoteric areas for more than a moment or two, but this kind of matter which packs the universe could easily be, by some form of physics we don't understand, used as a mechanism to physically move an object from one place to another, yes?
Sure. There is a, I think even NASA is building, well under construction, past the design phase, I think, a plasma engine for one of its space probes. And so, yeah, it'll just throw matter in plasma form out the back end instead of hot gas like normal rockets do.
Got it. Okay.
So, sure, it can be used for propulsion, sure.
Okay. All right. Go ahead and carry on wherever you'd like to go next.
Well, the only other thing I think that people should really realize is that, yes, this space is chock-a-block full of charge. It's a plasma. It's a plasma just like the plasma that we work with in plasma laboratories, just like the plasma in the neon sign that says eat here. So we can test it. We can test it in the laboratory. And Dr. Peratt, my good friend, did a simulation on a supercomputer of just a bunch of plasma particles and put in a magnetic field and let the plasma particles go and saw and observed how they would react. And lo and behold, they formed a model of a galaxy. And he has pictures in his book of what the galaxy looks like.
That's fascinating.
But the most important thing is that the galaxy, his model galaxy, rotated exactly the same way that real galaxies do in space, and astronomers can't explain that.
Can you please, Don, for me, we're going to take a two-minute break here. We'll come back. I'd like to revisit that and go back through that again in slow motion for people.
Okay.
That is truly fascinating.
Okay.
All right, hold on. Don Scott is my guest, and we'll be right back. Scott is here, a remarkable man, remarkable book. Do click on his name, take a few moments to take a look at it, and remember those reviews I read. There is so much excitement now when you look at the universe through the eyes of Don Scott, Walt Thornhill, David Talbot, and others. It is an electric universe. And all of these elaborate, exotic, eclectic explanations and theories being put forward to try to maintain the status quo, you know, I guess they're laughable, but they really are sad because it essentially points out the moribund state of much of our alleged scientists and their spirit of adventure and inquiry and probing where no man has probed before and all that.
Yeah, that's certainly right. There's we probably don't have enough time to talk about a fellow whose name is Holt Narp. I don't know if that's...
Well, we do. We've got this hour, and then Wall will join us next hour. So we've
But I'd rather keep it on plasma. But ARP, just to mention ARP, ARP was a graduate student of the very famous Edwin Hubble, and ARP was a user of the Mount Palomar and Mount Wilson telescopes for years and years and years. He was one of the most well-known, well-reputed astronomers in the United States, and he essentially, his contribution to astronomy was he took a series of images, a series of photographs. In those days, they used glass plates to get the big photographs on. But essentially, in broad brush terms, his photographs, if they didn't disprove, they certainly put into jeopardy the Big Bang theory. Well, as a result, Holt Narp was refused any further telescope time in the United States. He was essentially fired.
God.
He finds it very, very difficult to get anything published in the United States Astrophysical Journal. And
This is tyranny.
It's almost like everybody realizes what Galileo went through and the censorship and so on in those days. But we think, well, we're beyond that now. Well, we aren't, unfortunately. Anyway, ARP is alive and well. he's an elderly gentleman, a gentleman's gentleman. I love him.
Yeah.
He's at the Max Planck Institute now and still working.
Yeah, very good.
And it just shows the extent to which the science is not just a dispassionate search for the truth, but it's a political knife fight at times.
Wow.
One other thing, back to the plasma business, mm-hmm. that you might your listeners might be interested in is that I referred earlier to the fact that a foreign body in a plasma would be surrounded by a sort of a sheath, a cocoon, and if you stop to think about it, the space immediately surrounding the sun, in which all the planets ride, is a plasma. The popular name for it is the solar wind, but that's really a misnomer. It isn't the wind at all. But each one of the planets is surrounded by this little cocoon of plasma, and whether people realize that or not is questionable. You hear about people talking about the magnetosphere. Well, the magnetosphere is that's true. Most of the planets have a magnetic field. Venus is a notable example. It doesn't. Mars doesn't very much, but they do have plasma spheres, and plasma spheres is this little protective cocoon that surrounds each planet and essentially will protect that planet against collisions with other things. Like, for example, if we all read about the demise of the dinosaurs, and this could have been a comet or an asteroid impinging on the Earth. It may well have been, but if that event ever did happen, I would suspect what you would see first is that body would penetrate the Earth's plasma sphere, and you'd see a tremendous lightning exchange, an electrical exchange, because the bodies, the Earth and that incoming body, were at different voltages. The reason they're at different voltages is because presumably that body had been way out somewhere in the far distant reaches of the solar system.
So there'd be an arc.
And we actually saw something like this happen. I don't know if you recall, there was I think it was Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 or Shoemaker-Levy...
When it cracked up and railroad-trained its way into Jupiter.
Exactly. And if you look at the standard astronomical excuses for why did this thing break up? Well, it broke up because of the force of gravity. Well, if you stop and think about it, this thing was simply in free fall, just like all our satellites that are circling around Earth are in free fall, a circular free fall around Earth. And they're not undergoing any particular stresses or strains. And what happened was that Comet Shoemaker-Levy intersected the huge, huge plasma sphere. That Jupiter has the biggest plasma sphere of all the planets. The plasma sphere, if it were visible from Earth, just with the naked eye, would be larger than our full moon, and it's that big an
wow.
item, big a thing.
Wow.
And so when that comet came through, it was just fat humming, dumb and happy. I mean, just floating down, falling down. Whee! Here we go toward Jupiter. It was not experiencing any quote gravitational stress at all. Where the stress came is when it impinged. It went into that plasma sphere and exposed itself to the voltage difference between itself and Jupiter. And there's experimental evidence right now today that the moon Io or Eo, depending on your pronunciation, Io of mm-hmm. One of the four moons, the four largest moons of Jupiter,
yes.
is really electrically connected to Jupiter. And all of these, we see volcanoes supposedly on Io now. Well, they're not volcanoes. And if you ask the astronomers, well, of course they're volcanoes. We've seen them. They're plumes of material, and they're volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they've moved 45 miles since we first discovered them. Now, volcanoes don't move 45 miles in a couple of decades. Mount Vesuvius may be moving, mm-hmm. you know, on continental drift velocities, but not 45 miles in 20 years. So what our feeling is, this is an electrical arc, an electrical interchange between Io, which is, by the way, inside that plasma sphere of Jupiter. All of those four big moons are inside Jupiter's plasma sphere, and so are electrically connected to, if you wish, to Jupiter. And so there can be all sorts of scarring and interactions, electrical mm-hmm. interactions between mm-hmm. those moons and Jupiter.
Well, there's the Valles Marineris on Mars.
Oh, sure.
That's gigantic another. Gash on,
yeah.
on the planet.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, Wall is a... you should ask Wall about that.
Yeah, we will.
I'm in full agreement with him. We think that is an example of an electric arc scar. Clearly, it could not be made. If you look at it and look at the pictures that have been wonderful pictures that NASA has gotten of it, it's clearly not due to any kind of erosion. It doesn't flow from uphill to downhill. It's not a river. It doesn't have any delta. It has vertical sides to it. It's clearly not a river or not a canyon of any sort. We think it's the result of an electrical interaction between Mars and Lord knows what. I mean, there's another planet, another asteroid way back when. There's detritus scattered all over the surface of Mars. Everybody wonders, well, where do all these rocks come from? Well, if there was an electric arc, a huge electric arc coming down, carving that Valles Marineris, where did the stuff go? Well, it maybe was splattered all over the surface of Mars. In fact, maybe that's where some of those Martian meteorites that ended up here on Earth came from.
Well, I don't see why not.
Yeah.
When Wall comes on at the top of the next hour, we'll talk about what may have gone on in our solar system and how our ancients looked at things so much differently than they do now.
Yeah.
And there is a... Go ahead.
One of the I think the important things about electric cosmology is being different from regular cosmology and regular astronomy is that testing is very, very important. We can test plasmas in the laboratory, and we can test to see that, yes, there that stream of current coming from the sun does light up the aurora. And another thing that we can test is whether or not comets have charge. And Wall, and I would urge you to ask Wall about his prediction. He is, I think, outstanding in his prediction, successful prediction, about what was going to happen to this deep impact mission of NASA when they threw that block of copper at the incoming comet about 2 years ago, 4th
sure.
of July.
Well, we'll talk about that with him for sure.
Absolutely. And then I think the idea of testability is one of the things that distinguishes plasma cosmologists from astronomers. Astronomers want to be able to toss out anything and just say, oh, well, we're very surprised at this new data, but of course it's probably this piece of fairy dust that we've just invented that's responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas plasma cosmologists are more linked to the laboratory. No, we're going to test it. We're going to see if we can duplicate it. And one of the nice things about plasma is that galaxies, little models, and have this watch them rotate in the laboratory.
Oh, interesting.
So it's...
And I wanted you to go through that again, how the man created what amounted to a...
Okay, well, as every good author says, it's in my book.
Good. Well said. Let's stay with it right there then, Don Scott. We have to break now anyhow. So,
okay.
The Electric Sky. All you have to do is click on Don's name, and you'll see a page right where you can order it. It's right there. 6x9, big book, generous book, 256 pages, full color graphics. It's a superb book. Stand by, Don. We'll come right back, and we'll be joined by Wal Thornhill live from Australia in just a few minutes. Okay, and welcome back. Glad you're along tonight. Joining us now from Australia is scientist Wal Thornhill, who's been on this program many times over the years. Welcome back, Wal.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
It's good to talk to you again. Don Scott has been with us during the last hour. We've been talking about some extraordinary things. You and David Talbot, of course, have been on this program probably over 10 years ago. It was the first visit. And we've talked about the electric universe. There is a video online now. I'll be putting up a link to it. I want all of you listening to spend some time and look at this. It's absolutely fascinating. It's called Thunderbolts of the Gods. And I've looked at the first portion of it. It is wonderfully produced. Who produced this, Wal? I know you and Dave were involved with it.
Yes, the chief architect of that video was Ben Lowe from Canada.
Well, Ben did himself mighty proud. I can't wait to see the rest of it. All right, I don't know if you've been able to hear what we've been talking about, but say hello to Don. He's online here with us.
Hi, buddy. How are you doing?
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Good, thanks.
It's good to hear you.
Okay, where do we want to go with this, Wal? Do you want to just bring our listeners up to date? We've talked with you and David, of course, over the years about how the ancients saw the skies and some of the events that they probably were witness to. And we have to remember, folks, that the earlier peoples on this planet looked at the night skies as we would look at television. They were it was the greatest show on Earth in so many ways. Wouldn't you agree with that, Wal?
Yes, I would. We see films, most of us haven't seen an aurora in person, but we see some dramatic films of auroras. They would just be a tiny sideshow compared with what the ancients must have seen in the sky.
We talked about the tremendous gash on Mars as being one evidence of a tremendous voltage arc, perhaps, in space.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. You want to give us your view on planets? Now, Don was very careful to mention that there are, of course, plasmas around each of the planets that would act as, not necessarily a protective buffer, but certainly some kind of an interference with any approaching large object. And he suggested there would be a tremendous discharge of electricity, voltage-wise, an arc, if you will, from Earth to an approaching comet or an asteroid or some large body that would come nearby. Tell us more about that and what might happen, and what might the earlier solar system have looked like here?
Well, that's a long story. But
you have about, you can answer in 30 seconds, Walt.
Well, the planets, as you say, do have an electric shield around them. It's called the magnetosphere because it also traps the magnetic field of a planet. But that gives a false impression of what it actually is. Now, if the shields of two planets clash and they're sufficiently close, then it's like a short circuit between the two planets. And if you can imagine lightning on Earth is just a mere spark from a hairbrush, compared with the most powerful discharges that we actually see in laboratories on Earth,
mm-hmm.
The power of those things is phenomenal. And in the case of Valles Marineris, I realized some years ago that the shape of Valles Marineris and the surrounding terrain is precisely that of a spiral galaxy. And this ties in directly with the work of plasma cosmologists who have shown that galaxies themselves are probably the largest electrical discharge phenomenon in the universe. So here we have another example of the tremendous scaling of plasma from the laboratory, where you're talking about a few centimeters, to galaxies where you're talking about hundreds of thousands of light years. And, of course, on Mars, the scar would stretch right across the United States. So that had me puzzled for some time, trying to explain exactly what happened on Mars, but it's obvious now that Mars did receive a tremendous discharge, a tremendous blow. And when you look at that scar, you see all of the effects that you would expect from an electric arc traveling across the surface. It has nothing to do with water.
Okay, now, Don mentioned some of your work and your theory about this asteroid which was intercepted and a lot of photographs taken
Comet.
Of it.
Comet.
Yeah, I beg your pardon, Comet. If you would give us some some idea of what you see in that event and how it does validate what you and Dave Talbot and others have been saying for quite some time.
Yes, it was back at the time of Comet Halley. I had a visit from another physicist from Canada, Dr. Earl Milton, and he was very interested in Halley and also in Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 when it collided with Jupiter, or its fragments collided. And he wrote quite a bit about that, and he pointed out that the energy that was released when those comet fragments arrived at Jupiter far in excess of what you'd expect from a simple impact. And this, of course, is true, and the same thing happened at Comet Vilt 2 when the Deep Impact mission fired that projectile into its path. Because of the information that I'd gleaned from Earl Milton and my own research, I predicted several years before the experiment took place that there would be an electrical discharge between the copper projectile and the body of the comet just before it struck, and that the actual impact would be far more energetic than anyone expected. And, of course, this was borne out. I listened to the and watched the web TV from NASA control at the time of the impact, and just before, the scientists were saying they weren't sure that they would actually see anything at all.
Right. I remember that.
Now, both of these things I predicted, of course, were unexpected, in fact, very unexpected. But both of them were borne out, and this is always a good test of a theory.
Wow.
And
go ahead, Walt.
Of course, the point is that what I'm saying is that a comet is an electrical phenomenon, largely. All of the things we see in the sky, the glowing tail and the bright star-like nucleus,
mm-hmm.
are the result of electrical discharge.
Mm-hmm.
A small piece
mm-hmm.
of rock or ice, just a few kilometers across, would have no effect at all. It would be invisible if it weren't for its electrical outbursts.
So when we see, and there's a comet now, I guess it was visible a couple weeks ago. I put up a link with some pretty neat photographs.
That's right.
Was that, by the way, more profound visually, Don Scott, than Hale-Bopp, to your knowledge?
Not from these latitudes. Hale-Bopp was a spectacular thing. That just,
from Mars, yeah, I saw it. We all saw it.
Now, I think it was better observed from Australia, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was spectacular.
Comet,
it was the best thing I've seen.
Was it McNaughton? Is that what the name of it was? Something like that?
McNaught, I think.
McNaught, okay. But it wasn't Naught at all. It was quite something.
That's right.
So you were able to see it down there, and it was pretty amazing.
I sure did, and it's the best comet I've seen.
Wow. All right.
That's fantastic.
So
you lucky guy, you.
Yeah, indeed. So what you're saying, Wal, is a comet, you know, a small block of ice, and who knows what, debris, rocks, some kind of geologic material. The comet head itself is ordinarily how big? What's the range?
A few kilometers. The point is that people have always believed that comet nuclei were made largely of ice simply because they couldn't figure out how you would get such a display in the sky if there wasn't something that could evaporate into space and be lit up by the sun. But the point is that every time we've looked closely at a comet or sampled the dust from a comet, it's been a total surprise because the water hasn't been there or not in sufficient quantities to explain the display of a comet.
So, go ahead, Don.
Well, when you mentioned this to start off, Wal's talking about that that prediction of his, I corrected you, and I really have to apologize for correcting you. I said, no, it wasn't an asteroid, it was a comet. Well, if you stop to think about it, at least in Wal's opinion, I shouldn't speak for Wal, but I think he agrees with what I'm saying, and that is that there's really very little difference between an asteroid and a comet. The only thing that really is different is the orbit. The comet has a very highly elliptical orbit.
Elliptical, yeah.
And the asteroid is more circular. Elliptical, sure, but almost more circular. But I don't think that a comet is any more constitutive of a compact snowball than asteroid Ida or any of the other asteroids.
Oh, thank you for that. What about this, Wal, then? So, for our listeners, a comet somehow is accessing the energy in the so-called vacuum of space to there's an electrical differential there that we're seeing. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. The theory goes that a comet spends a lot of its time traveling very slowly in the outer reaches of the solar system. And the voltage there, because of the huge distances involved, are quite different from what they are in the inner solar system. So the comet, while it's coasting out in the outer solar system, more or less achieves the same voltage as its surroundings.
I see.
When it begins to rush into the inner solar system, things start to change more and more rapidly the closer it gets to the sun. And it can't adjust sufficiently to get rid of the electric charge. So it begins to go into various forms of the classical glow discharge phenomena. And everything we've seen about comets, the close-up pictures and everything, all show these electrical effects. In fact, the early flybys, the scientists were amazed at the energetic events they were encountering.
Right, indeed. Stand by right there, Wal. We'll pause and come right back and pick it up. Don, if you would be so kind, we spent just a couple of minutes earlier in the first hour on the idea of contemporary science and scientists and their paradigm and their ego enterprises trying to maintain things with more and more spit and baling wire all the time, coming up with more and more exotic explanations and rationale. And I think it would be great to restate that and have Wal comment on it as well, even naming one of these phenomena, which is apparently quite simple to explain in a very complex kind of framework, and calling it after naming it after Stephen Hawking. If you would do that again, I'd love to hear it again.
Well, what I was saying was that there is one of these inventions on the part of mainstream astronomers is the so-called Hawking radiation from black holes, and I think even Stephen Hawking has sort of reneged a little bit on it. But you have to follow it day by day to see what they're still saying is true and what they're saying, well, they've made a mistake on. Mostly, it is an excuse for the observation of these huge galactic jets of matter and energy that are shooting, streaming out of many galaxies, especially the so-called Seyfert galaxies and the AGNs, the active galactic nuclei. And the idea is that, I think it was Hawking, or at least his name is credited with the idea, came up with the idea that there was a black hole, which was at the center of such galaxies. This black hole would suck matter and light and energy and everything into it, and then sort of rebound it out in a stream. And how that happens or why that happens or what the physics and what holds the stream together is all just ignored. It's just an excuse for the observation that there are these jets out there. And
The theory has no substance.
That's right. And the gravity attracts. And electromagnetism, both electric fields and magnetic fields, and certainly plasma, has the ability both to attract and repel. And so when you see things being repelled, being spurted out of galaxies, the first thing that should come to your mind is some mechanism that actually can repel, which is, of course, electromagnetism, not gravity, which only attracts.
Correct.
So that's...
So there are no black holes.
I don't think there are, no. In fact, the originator... It's hard to decide who was the first guy who came up with the idea of a black hole. There was a fellow by the name of Wheeler who was he's at the University of Texas, was at Princeton for a while, I think. He's an emeritus professor. He was quoted as saying he was the inventor of this so-called naked singularity in space, which is a singularity, an accumulation of matter so dense that it sucks everything, including light, into it, so you can't see it, but it's there. And he said that he would be willing to bet that the formation of something like that was as equally likely as jumping across the Gulf of Mexico. He said, I can't prove it, but I can't prove that it can't happen.
Yeah.
Well, that's dishonest. That's what's called the argumentum ignorantium, which
it's
is the argument from ignorance. That if you haven't disproved it, you got to admit that it could happen.
Well, please.
That's not the way science is arrived at.
Yeah. Wall, any comments on that?
Oh, I agree with Don. The notion of black holes was developed to fit the mathematics and not the real world. And this, unfortunately, is a tendency in modern physics that mathematics holds sway, and yet as several top scientists have pointed out, that mathematics ain't physics. And one of the problems you run into is the misuse of language, and it strikes right at the very heart of even the Big Bang Theory. For instance, the famous equation that Einstein produced, E equals MC squared, stands for mass, and yet even reading encyclopedias, you will find within a sentence or two, they will have switched to using the word matter. And that is not what Einstein was talking about. And yet we hear about in the Big Bang that energy is converted into matter, and that's not correct. It doesn't fit Einstein's science. It doesn't fit anybody's science. In fact, it defies one of the principles of physics, that you can't create something from nothing. And yet this is at the very heart of the Big Bang Theory. And the same kind of thing goes on with black holes. They saw this extreme energy coming from a very small source, and the only way to do that with gravity, which is an almost infinitely weak force, was to have an infinitely heavy object. It's the old schoolboy howler of dividing by zero and ending up with infinity.
So no black holes. You mean that Hollywood space movie I saw was wrong, where they actually flew their spaceship through a black hole? Gee!
Yes.
You can't trust anybody anymore.
Well, it's like Alice in Wonderland. If you just know where to walk through the looking glass and then wish very hard, then everything is real.
Yeah. Yeah. Einstein and his theories. There is a tremendous cult to protect Einstein from all comers. And any questions?
Yeah.
First, you, Don Scott, what do you see as Einstein's ultimate future? We had a break here, so I'll give you a couple minutes to think about that. There is a tremendous resistance to criticizing Einstein's work by a lot of scientists.
Oh, very much so.
Who want to hold on to that reality as their reality and the reality of everything because it makes things simple. Or simpler. All right, we'll be back in a minute and find out what our two expert scientists have to say about Einstein, his work, and his future in our world as we continue. Gentlemen, the future of Mr. Einstein in your estimation?
Well, let me give a quick and dirty answer and then give it over to Wall, who's much better informed on this than I am.
Right.
Just consider yourself that nothing in Einstein's postulates or in Alexander Friedman's solution of his postulates leading to the curvature of space and all of this kind of thing, nothing in there is electrical. Einstein completely ignored everything electrical. Half of man's knowledge about the way things work is electrical.
That's like trying to describe the planet Earth without mentioning the oceans.
Exactly. And this is supposedly a cosmic explanation of everything. Where did we come from? Where? How are we going to end up? And all the rest of it.
Uh-huh.
If it's so cosmic, how can you ignore electricity? Well, that's my comment. But even Einstein wasn't very happy with it, and I know Wall wants to comment on that.
Okay. All right, Wall, go ahead. You got the stage here.
Okay, yes, I have great regard for Einstein as a man and his integrity, but I don't have such regard for the people who followed him, who I think were on an ego trip, saying they understood his work when in fact it's actually doesn't make any sense. I know that Einstein himself, before he died, was actually looking into the possibility that electromagnetism did play a role in the solar system. It's
unfortunate that he died. Well, wasn't there communication between he and Velikovsky? About this and it was not able to reach fruition.
That's right. The meetings were documented by Velikovsky, and it's clear that Einstein was very interested in the possibility. In fact, the whole, I think at the end of the 21st century, we'll look back on Einstein and say that he, or his followers more likely, actually derailed science for the 20th century. Because it's a kind of an accident of history that both quantum theory and relativity theory began to take a hold early in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, plasma physics was more or less in its infancy. There was a lot to be learnt. If it had been the other way around, relativity theory and quantum theory would not have got the hold that they've got over us right now. I say quantum theory's got problems too because it's a physical theory where cause and effect are divorced, becomes probabilistic. And once you have a probabilistic theory, you can postulate almost anything you like, and there's a finite possibility that it may occur. It's a bit like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the spaceship with the infinite improbability drive. I think Douglas Adams was having fun with quantum theory when he wrote that
Well, he probably was. He was a very bright man, and wouldn't surprise me. So quantum physics, as we know, quantum physics is really due for some very serious overhauling at some point.
Yes,
fairly soon.
I know Lee Smolin in his recent book, Questioning String Theory, also feels that quantum theory is causing problems when you're trying to bring Einstein's theory of gravity together with quantum theory, and you've got two flawed theories, and trying to bring them together, of course you're going to have problems.
Well, you know, one of the things that it seems to me that people should bear in mind is that all physical laws have domains of validity. For example, if you think about the forces that we know about gravitation, we know about electromagnetism, we know about the strong and weak nuclear force that is at work inside the atom. And the strong and weak nuclear force can be completely ignored if you're thinking about putting a spaceship into orbit. And gravity can be completely ignored if you're wondering about what holds those neutrons and protons together in air, keeps them from flying apart. So that it's the domain of validity of these laws is not infinite. And so it may well be that quantum mechanics it predicted the existence of the tunnel diode, and the tunnel diode really is a real item. So it has had some successes. But when you try to expand that realm of validity into a cosmic truism, that's when you run into trouble. So my opinion is that gravity also has a finite domain of validity, and it just doesn't extend to how galaxies operate. And Maxwell's equations, the idea of electromagnetism, that is valid over a wider range of validity than Newton's gravity is.
Interesting. Fascinating.
Yes, I agree with Don. The point is that the mathematics can actually give you correct answers, even when your physical model, or lack of a physical model, underpins it. But if you continue to try and work without having a good physical model, and then you are running a big risk. And this is certainly the case with quantum theory. In the case of relativity, it's suggesting things that are totally beyond our normal experience. And as a result, you also have to tread very carefully. The difference between these two theories and working with plasma science is that all of these things are testable in the laboratory. And it is possible to make predictions based on the observations that you make in the laboratory and then have them confirmed in outer space.
I see.
Most of the predictions made from Big Bang Theory and that can be adjusted because the models are so complex that it's almost impossible to falsify them.
The models are so complex it's almost impossible to falsify them.
It's like having so many knobs to adjust on the control panel that whatever you find, you can twiddle a knob somewhere and get the result out that you want that matches your observation.
I see. And not good. So the last century, in terms of scientific advancement, was derailed, was actually almost sent into what we call a cul-de-sac here, or a dead-end road, or a box canyon or something.
Well, right. Scientists got the idea, at least some scientists got the idea, that they could divorce themselves from experiment. They could sit behind their desk
and
study
think.
Higher mathematics,
and write. Yeah.
do Gedanken experiments, which are, you know, thought experiments, instead of real experiments in the laboratory, and that's led them into disaster. At least in Wall's opinion and my opinion. And by the way, it's not just Wall and myself and Dave Talbot, but there are many, many people who, there's Eric Lerner, who wrote The Big Bang Never Happened. He's also a plasma cosmologist. There's Tony Perrat, as my name I mentioned before, and many other people who are in our camp as well. So.
Right. Very good. Stand by, gentlemen. We'll pause and come right back with more, our discussion about the universe and all its varying parts with Don Scott and Wal Thornhill. right back with Don Scott and Wal Thornhill. Our solar system, Wal, was apparently considerably different not very long ago. Let's just sketch that out. And again, I'm pointing people to Thunderbolt of the Gods, the marvelous video. And if you just look, folks, under the guests section tonight, you'll see a direct link to Thunderbolts of the Gods. Tell us what our solar system may have looked like, Wal, and we'll do. We only have about 10 minutes left, so you don't have to go very far into it. But it was okay. Very different, apparently, not very long ago.
Yes, the standard storybook is that the planets formed after the sun out of the debris left over from the collapse of a cloud of gas and dust. And no one's been able to show how that could work. And when you look at the solar system, it's a complete fruit salad of objects, axial spin rates and axial tilts and atmospheres and composition. It's very hard to make a solar system with that very simple original model. I've claimed in the past, based on Velikovsky's work initially, but also on work that other people have done, including Duarte Cardona, and his book Godstar, which is also available on thunderbolts.info, that the history of the Earth is far more interesting and, in fact, would beat any science fiction story into a cocked hat, because it seems that planets themselves are born just like human beings from a mother object. And so, first of all, you have to have a star, which then gives birth to gas giants. We've seen plenty of those around other stars nearby. And that's puzzled astronomers because they can't figure out how they were formed so close to their parent. Then the gas giants themselves may undergo what's called electrical fissioning to produce satellites. And that's obvious because we look at Jupiter and Saturn and they've got a huge number of satellites. And what the suggestion is that in the past the Earth was actually a satellite of Saturn. But Saturn itself wasn't a part of this solar system. It itself was a brown dwarf star. And under those conditions and under the requirements of the electric star theory, the Earth would have received similar heat and light over every square inch of the surface, regardless of our axial tilt, our orbit, or anything like that, because we were orbiting inside a glowing red plasma shell. And this is... We see these kinds of stars all around the place. They're called red dwarfs and even red giants in some cases for the very big ones. And there's plenty of room for planets to orbit inside the atmosphere of a star. We do it with the sun. We orbit inside the solar wind. According to the very earliest recollections of mankind, and this is going back to just before the dawn of civilization, they described the sky as being purple, purple dawn of creation. The lighting was different. The atmosphere was different. The climate was different. There was no seasons, and so on. So what this suggests is that our original star, what we call proto-Saturn, encountered our present sun electrically, and the result was the tearing apart of proto-Saturn, the dwarf star's system of satellites. It has kept quite a few satellites of its own. And the most interesting one, of course, is Titan, which is the largest small planet in the solar system, except that it's still orbiting Saturn. It has a heavier atmosphere than the Earth, and if it was closer into the sun, would, I'm sure, provide a place for life. So what you have is a very dynamic history of the solar system, and it's only in a time span of measured in, say, 10,000 years or so, that the solar system has settled down into what appears to be a clockwork system that we see today. And it's only clockwork because electrical forces tend to prevent oscillations or departures from regularity.
They like stability, and I see.
That's right. It introduces the stability. Now, none of this electrical aspect has been considered by astronomers, and so this is a whole new area for budding astronomers to enter. There's so much work to be done. All we've done is sketch in the outline of what's happened based on all of the evidence that we can gather. from the very earliest recollections of mankind, from petroglyphs, from their renditions of obvious plasma discharges in the sky. Those plasma discharges that were witnessed are direct evidence of the fact that the Earth was undergoing severe orbital changes at the time. And the fact that we survived at all is a minor miracle, I suppose. But there are other sources of energy that provide heat and light and the energy to live besides the sun. And these are all the kinds of things which are opened up as possibilities, possibilities that are not even on the radar of modern science.
So a planet without a sun, or a sun diminishing, or a sun...
Any object floating alone in deep space will receive energy from the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is not completely out of the question for a large enough planet to actually have life on it without having its own star.
Extraordinary to contemplate.
This provides a completely different view of the possibility of life in the universe. It also suggests why we can't or haven't contacted E.T., because anybody living within the glowing envelope of a brown dwarf or a red dwarf star would have no idea what was outside that red shell, wouldn't even know that a universe existed.
Couldn't see.
So that, and also no radio waves can penetrate that plasma, glowing plasma shell.
Mm.
So they wouldn't receive our radio or TV signals anyway and would have no reason to try and respond.
I see.
So in some ways you can consider the Earth and the human race is now being very lucky and also very privileged to be able to see the spectacle of deep space.
Not everyone enjoys that. Interesting. Don,
yes.
Your thoughts?
Well, before I mentioned the idea of the plasma cocoon, and Wall just referred to it, also that surrounds each one of the planets. Also, there's one that surrounds the entire solar system. That is, it's called the heliosphere. Or its boundary is called the heliopause.
Oh,
and,
I see.
And that boundary is the one that, if indeed this proto-Saturn was drifting along through space, it would not have had any interaction with the sun, the original, what is now our sun, until Saturn's plasma sphere intersected the sun's heliosphere. And then they would see each other electrically, and then literally all hell would break loose, and there would be a breakup of all sorts of whatever was the previous configuration, and things would go flying around and hopefully end up in the kind of roulette wheel that we have now.
Mm-hmm. About 3 minutes left, Wall. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the reasons why capture of objects in space has never been considered very probable is that it's only considered gravity. But when you introduce the electrical exchanges between bodies, it becomes highly probable, particularly when you consider that the size of the sun electrically is about 100 times the size of the Earth's orbit. And therefore, it's a very large object traveling through space. And
mm-hmm.
So these kinds of encounters are not out of the question.
Is the sun running out of energy? There are people who suggest the sun has been acting in very aberrant fashion lately, and that there are things to worry about and all the rest of it. Wall, a quick comment on that.
We have this childish belief that the sun has radiated heat and light to the Earth for 4.5 billion years. It is wishful thinking. The sun, like all stars, is variable depending on the power that you feed to it. So if somebody somewhere turns the dimmer switch, then things could change. And I think this is behind our current global warming scare. Whoever's flicking or playing with the dimmer switch could also turn it down again. So I would say there's no inevitability about global warming.
I see. So global warming, in your estimation, is not, in fact, directly due to so-called fossil fuel burning, greenhouse gases and all of that, as much it is a factor of major solar system physics,
yeah.
If not galactic physics.
Well, we see
the
polar ice caps on Mars are retreating as well.
Right.
So you must have an awful powerful SUV if you're going to affect the polar ice caps on Mars.
Yeah, well, whoever has his or her finger on the great rheostat in the sky is definitely playing games with things, turning the voltage up and turning the voltage down.
It seems
apparently
so.
Over
That's right.
An enormous distance, not just
I
here.
Think as Don may have pointed out, the sun has an inbuilt mechanism to provide fairly steady heat and light output even when the power is varying into it. The point is that all the planets participate in this electrical power, and it's never factored into any climate model.
Most interesting. Wall, a final comment from you tonight, then we must say goodbye for this visit.
Well, all I can say is that the science of the 21st century will bear no resemblance to that of the 20th century. I just hope that we reach that point in the early part of the century so that I can see it rather than later.
Indeed. Thanks very much for being here again, Wall. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. And, Don, a final word from you, sir?
I'll just say amen to everything Wall said. One final quick suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
There is another URL that's thunderbolts.info.
Right.
And if you go there, you can get into a list of an archive called Teapots, the Thunderbolt Picture of the Day. And that's, an excellent reference source for people interested in this sort of thing. It's Wall has written many of those, and if you want to just look up comets or look up galaxies or whatever, it's all, the archive is all searchable.
Very good. And all you have to do is click on Wall Thornhill's name and you'll go to thunderbolts.info. Click on Don Scott's name and you'll go to a page that shows his book, The Electric Sky. Thank you, Don. It's been great. I look forward to another conversation with you in the future.
Well, me too, Jeff. It's been a great pleasure for me as well.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, Doug.
Night. Don Scott and Wall Thornhill. Quite a lot to think about. Exciting times if we can keep from blowing it all, as it were. Back in a few minutes. Well, let's call it 21 hours. It seems like a few minutes anyhow. Take care. Talk tomorrow night.